Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The more I traveled around the world, the more I tried to raise awareness about the things that are going wrong on this planet, the more I felt desperately sorry for young children when I look at them and think how we've damaged the world since I was their age, the more I began to realize how much of the damage was actually caused by the way we produce the food we eat, whether this is with agriculture, the crops, the chemical pesticides and fertilizers and fungicides that we put on the ground, the way that these leach down into the groundwater and end up in the streams and the rivers, the lakes, and finally into the sea.
Today, renowned primatologist Jane Goodall, yes, the chimpanzee lady, on her guide to mindful eating, animals, the environment, and her life. But first, Native American communities continue to struggle in the deep bayous of Louisiana. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Isolated and marginalized in normal times, today we look at the plight of Native Americans in the deep bayous of Louisiana in the aftermath of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Aid has been slow in reaching these communities. Tribal members are still awaiting much-needed supplies from FEMA. There's evidence the tribes have suffered disproportionately from the devastation of the hurricanes because they've been overlooked by federal agencies and relief organizations. Tribal members say relief efforts have been hindered because they don't have federal recognition as Native American tribes. The communities have state recognition, but have been struggling for federal recognition for decades. One tribal chief says FEMA was very slow because it didn't even know the tribes existed. Tribal members also say a general lack of media coverage has kept the public in the dark about the community's plight. Independent filmmaker Gregory Berger recently spoke with tribal leaders of the Biloxi Chitimacha tribes in southern Louisiana. He files this report.
These are the bayous of southern Louisiana. If you're not from here, then you probably don't know that it is home to more than 20,000 Native Americans.
We're in the Isla Jean Charles Band of Biloxi Chitimacha's community. Most of this area was underwater during right after Hurricane Rita came through.
Chief Randy Verdun of the Bayou Lafourche Band of the Biloxi Chitimacha.
Our community, Bayou Lafourche, Band of Biloxi Chitimachas. They came in mid to late 1800s, and it was my grandmother's grandfather who was the first one here.
The island started back in around, I guess, 1835, 1840 maybe.
Chief Albert Nakan of the Ile de Jean Charles Band of Biloxi Chitimacha.
I was born in 1946, same year as Albert. We're born in Dulac. I was born at home with a midwife.
Chairwoman Marlene Foray of the Grand Kailu Dulac Band of the Biloxi Chitimacha.
My parents, my dad was a fisherman, a trapper, and like Albert, you know, did all the gardening and fishing. We lived off the waters and the land, because gardening and fishing.
And with that, that there was some trading going on. I mean, it's not everybody that would raise the same thing. So some people would raise certain things in their garden, and it's just like the fishing part also. My dad fished a speckled trout, and he'd catch shrimps and oysters. But then there were some others that would go crabbing and do other things, so we'd swap fish for crabs and what have you.
In the aftermath of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, both of which affected the area, the media paid almost no attention to the problems facing Indian communities in coastal Louisiana.
You may see it in local newspapers or local news media. The only way you'll really find out information is if you maybe do a search on the internet. I'm not sure why that is, but that's just the way it played out this time. And I think for the most part, it's the way it's been for a long time. You know, you just don't see the plight of the poor people in these Indian communities. You just don't see it.
But it wasn't just the media that ignored these communities.
FEMA. hadn't even heard that there was some communities past Houma, I believe it was. So they didn't know anything about Native Americans in the lower bayous. All they knew was the little maps that they would see with the highways. But the in the maps that they have, our community don't even sure exist on there. So yeah, FEMA actually admitted that they didn't know that they had Indians, people living in the lower bayous.
I haven't seen anything from the federal or state. FEMA, I don't think anybody's heard from FEMA since the storm, unless they went on the internet.
Native American communities in the bayous were left to fend for themselves. Yet FEMA's failure to respond was only the latest incident in a history filled with neglect and abuse of Native American communities.
As time went on in the, I guess, the 1940s, when the oil boom came, a lot of the land started changing hands, and some of that was done, I think, maybe in some ways underhandedly. We have some stories that a lot of the land was supposedly leased to oil companies, and in fact a lot of these people were signing bills of sale, and I think even forgery.
We were living on my grandfather's property, and grandpa was the owner until grandma got sick, and then he had to kind of go to the grocery store and buy groceries and put the land up for collateral, and eventually was unable to repay, and the land got taken from him. I don't think he was even offered to pay, because I don't think he ever saw a bill for the property.
I think what made it easy, I think what made Indian people easy targets, first, there were few of them were educated. At best, in my father's generation, at best, they had a seventh grade education. In my grandparents' generation, they had no education. So they couldn't read, they couldn't write, even if they wanted to take some type of action to stop those things that were happening to them, that was happening all around them. They weren't able to.
Compounding the challenges Indians faced to try to hold on to their land, they soon faced a new threat. The land itself began to disappear.
You know, what basically caused us to be more vulnerable than, especially in light of these hurricanes, with when the oil field came in, they started drilling and they started digging their canals to bring their drilling equipment. Those canals were dug specifically for that drilling equipment. So they dug it. It was, you know, just sufficient size to get the equipment in and out. But those things were left once the drilling was completed. But those canals were left open. And you can look at some of the aerial photographs from 1940 all the way to the present. And what started out to be a canal maybe, you know, 60, 80 feet wide is now, you know, several hundred yards wide. And it's just opened up the salt water to come in and just eat away the marsh like a cancer. And you're just losing, and they talk about it all the time, losing football fields a day.
The community is more vulnerable now than it was way back. Oil companies came in and drilled for gas, oil, and dug canals and many of them, and the water kept coming in, and salt water, and it just killed the vegetation there. And then as the water was coming in, then the land could not replenish itself.
And also the pipelines. See, like I said, we had like seven pipelines. So to lay the pipeline, they also dig a canal. What it does, it takes the land, and water takes over. Water fills up that deal, and then water comes in a lot faster. Like now, like for when I was a little bit of a kid, okay, you're looking at between high tide and low tide, you're looking about, oh, I guess maybe 6 maybe to 10 inches, depending, I guess, on which way the wind was coming from. And now you're looking at probably 2 feet an hour with a good strong, good solid wind. So like you see, all of our oak trees are dying, and I guess 5, 10 years, depending on how much salt water we get. You know, all the trees on the island are probably going to be all dead.
And it's going to keep on going further up from the way it looks today with the two hurricanes here.
After generations of being gradually pushed out into the bayous, and with the land now literally disappearing from under their feet, it was inevitable that hurricanes Katrina and Rita would disproportionately affect Native American communities.
Katrina wasn't too bad. We had wind damage. We had five homes that needed major roof repair. But then Rita came around with the water.
A majority of big, I'd say 80% of the homes in the community went underwater. Not totally under, but I mean they had several feet of water in the homes.
As the water came up, it left a lot of the dirt once the water receded. You can see it on the roads. You can see it in the homes itself. If you walk into the homes, you might have an inch, 2-3 inches of dirt, which all has to be cleaned out. People are starting to clean up. You see a lot of the debris, household items, mattresses, appliances all outside now. Those things are no longer useful.
So what do Indian communities propose to do about it? Above all, they wish to be heard.
I think there's a breakdown in communication because if they didn't know we existed, how can they serve you?
The people in the community could solve the problem better because they know what's going on. I mean, they're there every day. The Red Cross and FEMA to come say, what can we do to help? I mean, how can we help? In other words, and we could give them the answer on how to help us. Better than them sitting over there saying, well, let's do this for these people, let's do that for these people. Sometimes we don't need that. I mean, we need something else.
Many Indian people also want a comprehensive levee system that might protect them from future storms.
Well, they would have to have the levee, the Morganza to the Gulf, as they're calling it. And people are just going to have to try to get behind the... Not behind, push the federal government into giving money so that these levees can be built to protect it.
But, you know, ain't nobody want to listen to me. So I guess I'm going to go there with my sack of cement and build it myself. But no.
But in the uphill battle to protect themselves from future hurricanes in the Gulf, one key political obstacle stands in the way of the Indian people of the Louisiana Gulf Coast. Federal recognition. As of yet, the Bureau of Indian Affairs has yet to grant any of the Indian tribes of the region federal recognition status.
Being federally recognized, you basically become an entity of and by itself, which is basically on the same playing field as a state. If you're federally recognized, then you have access to federal funds. You probably have a lot less bureaucracy. You have a direct connection with the federal government because you are, you go straight to the BIA, and the BIA of it by itself is its own agency, so you don't have all the red tape, and I think you have a direct connection to federal relief efforts.
And I really believe if they would have the protection, people would move back to their community, move back into the Dulac and Grand Cayo, lower Dulac and Grand Cayo area.
I am proud to be an Indian. The government, they want to buy out the people on the bayou. And, I mean, you know, they don't have enough money in the world to buy out these people because the people love the bayou. Bush better have a lot of money to put us back in, you know, back, restore us back. Because he's not going to stop us. He's not going to stop us.
For Democracy Now!, this is Greg Berger reporting from southern Louisiana.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. And to see the video and photographs, the images of the deep bayous of Louisiana, you can go to our website and watch the video podcast or listen to the audio podcast. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now on this holiday weekend to the meals that friends and families will share, we talk about food with renowned primatologist Jane Goodall. Her latest book is Harvest for Hope, A Guide to Mindful Eating. Jane Goodall, yes, is known as the Chimpanzee Lady for her groundbreaking work with chimpanzees and baboons. She now turns her attention to the food we eat and how it reaches our tables. In her book, Goodall examines the dangers of corporate ownership of water and the patenting of seeds, the hazards of genetically modified foods, and the existence of inhumane animal factories. Jane Goodall recently joined us in our Firehouse studios for an extended conversation, and we began at the beginning. I asked Jane Goodall about where she was born.
I was born in London, in England, in 1934. I went through, as a child, the horrors of World War II, through a time when food was rationed, and we learned to be very careful, and we never had more to eat than what we needed to eat. There was no waste. Everything was used. Then, because I had this passion for animals and fell in love with Tarzan, by the time I was 11, I was dreaming of going to Africa and living with animals and writing books about them. We didn't have any money, but eventually I managed to save up enough, having been invited to Africa by a school friend, to go out by boat to Kenya. I was 23, met the late Louis Leakey, the famous anthropologist, paleontologist, and that led to him offering me this extraordinary opportunity to go and study our closest living relatives in the wild, the chimpanzees.
Talk about what you did with the chimpanzees.
The chimpanzees study was... Well, it's still going on. And I think it's taught us, perhaps more than anything else, to be a little humble, that we are indeed unique primates, we humans, but we're simply not as different from the rest of the animal kingdom as we used to think. Above all, we're not the only beings with personalities, minds, and above all, feelings. And this gives one a new respect, not only for the chimpanzees, but once you realize there is no sharp line dividing us from the other animals, but a very blurry line, then you get a new respect for so many of the other amazing animals with whom we share this planet.
You went when you were in your 20s. Talk about the first studies you did, how you spent your time observing the chimpanzees.
The biggest problem when I first got there was that they're very conservative. They'd never seen a white ape before. And as soon as they saw me, they would vanish silently into the forest. And although I was in my dream world and loved being there and waking up every morning with the sounds of the birds and the insects and the calls of the chimpanzees, we only had money for 6 months because at that time I had no degree of any sort. It had been extremely difficult for Louis Leakey to get money, you know, this crazy idea of a young, untrained girl straight from England going out into the jungle, studying animals known to be stronger than us. But eventually, yes, a wealthy American businessman gave money for 6 months. But I knew if I didn't see something exciting in those first 6 months, that would be the end of the study, and I would have let Louis Leakey down.
And so what happened?
Fortunately, a breakthrough occurred just before the 6 months' money ran out, and I will never forget that day. Going through the wet undergrowth, I was rather cold and miserable.
Where were you?
In Gombe National Park. The whole study took place in Gombe National Park on the eastern shore of Lake Tanganyika. And so there I was, kind of depressed, and then I saw this dark shape hunched over the golden soil of a termite mound, and peering through my binoculars, because the chimpanzees were still not habituated to me, I saw a chimpanzee hand reach out and pick a piece of grass, push it down into the mound, leave it for a moment, withdraw it, and bite off the termites clinging on. I saw him reach out and pick a leafy twig and strip the leaves. He was not only using a tool, he was modifying an object, making a tool. And at that time, it was thought that we and only we used and made tools. That separated us from the animal kingdom, from all the other animals, more than anything else. And we were known as man the toolmaker. So this was so exciting. I did not report it to Louis Leakey until I'd seen it a couple of times more. I thought maybe my eyes were deceiving me. I mean, it was really such a breakthrough, so amazing.
And why is it so incredible that, well, first that we use tools and then that the chimpanzees do?
Well, it isn't really. It's just that, you know, evolution has led to a continuum of more and more complex behavior as the brain has evolved into a more and more complex organ, and we're capable of very sophisticated problem solving. And one of the ways we solve problems is to use tools, make tools, manufacture tools. It's led to modern technology. And because animals, for the most part, aren't seen using tools, then the very fact that they can have the intelligence to design a tool in nature was considered to be absolutely extraordinary. It didn't seem so to me. But you have to remember that back then, it really was thought that there was this sharp line dividing us from the rest of the animals. And when I first got to Cambridge University, because Lewis said I had to get a degree to get money for myself, I was told that everything I'd done in that study of 1.5 years was wrong. I shouldn't have given the chimpanzees names because that wasn't scientific. I should have numbered them. I couldn't talk about their personality, their mind, and above all, not their feelings, their emotions, because those things were unique to us. So there was a very, very different perception of animal behavior back then. And most scientists only admitted that animals were little bundles of stimulus and response. And they might look as if they behaved in a human way, but that was just our interpretation. And so the study of animal behavior back then was very cold. They were struggling to make it into a hard science. And any empathy or feeling for the animals you were studying was considered absolutely wrong.
Jane Goodall, the primatologist, the chimpanzee lady, author of Harvest for Hope, A Guide to Mindful Eating. We'll be back in a minute.
You were lost and got lucky, came upon the shore, found you a conquering America. You spoke of peace, waged a war, while you were conquering America.
Tracy Chapman, America, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we return to Jane Goodall, the primatologist. Her new book is called Harvest for Hope. I asked her what she makes of the whole debate against evolution, the whole issue of so-called intelligent design.
Whatever we believe about how we got to be the extraordinary creatures we are today is far less important than bringing our intellect to bear on how do we get together now around the world and get out of the mess that we've made. That's the key thing now. Never mind how we got to be who we are. Let's work out a way so that we can preserve what's left of this planet and enhance it for future generations.
Now, I want to talk about that because that's really what your life work is now all about, what your book, Harvest for Hope, is about. But just for a moment on that issue, since kids spend many, many hours in school and this debate is raging, what you think of it?
I was brought up to understand Darwin's theory of evolution. I spent hours and hours in the Natural History Museum in London looking at the descriptions of how different kinds of animals had evolved, looking at the sequence of fossil bones looking gradually more and more and more and more like the modern fossil. And the same applies to the remains of humans. And I think one of the big questions is, people say to me, but surely if you believe in evolution, there's no place for God. I absolutely don't agree with that. The more I learn about this absolutely awesome and fantastic and wonderful planet and the universe, the incredible nature of the human mind, the more I feel convinced that there is some kind of great spiritual power I feel as a meaning to our life on earth. And that does not at all conflict with the idea of gradual evolution.
We're talking to Jane Goodall. Yes, the chimpanzee lady, as many have called her over the decades. She's written a new book now called Harvest for Hope, A Guide to Mindful Eating. And I do want to talk about that, but I want to ask how you remain studying chimpanzees for so many decades and how it grew, and then if you could weave it into the subject of this book.
The chimpanzee study originally, Lewis Leakey thought that it probably would last he thought 10 years. When I began, the longest study that had been done in the wild on animals was George Schaller's one-year study of the mountain gorilla. And, of course, Lewis was right, but 10 years wouldn't have been nearly enough to uncover the complexities. For one thing, chimpanzees can live to be more than 60 years. For another, they are absolutely individuals, so that you can't just generalize about behavior. The individual, the experiences, the kind of mothering, the events that have shaped that individual's life create a whole number of unique individuals. So we're continually getting new surprises. We've still only been able to study the development of one pair of twins in all these years. And the tragedy today is that if we're not very careful, we'll end up studying the extinction of a small population of chimpanzees. Because all around the tiny Gombe National Park, which is only 30 square miles, rather suddenly, the human population increased because of large numbers of refugees from Burundi, from Congo. And so cultivated fields now come right up to the boundaries. There's less than 100 chimpanzees living in the park in three communities.
Used to be?
There used to be 150. And now there's really only one viable community. And so in the long run, there won't be a big enough gene pool for genetic viability. So in order to try to save the chimpanzees, I discovered this very suddenly. I flew over the whole area in a small plane about 15 years ago, and I was absolutely shocked. And the question came, how can we even try to save these amazing chimpanzees if the people are so obviously struggling to survive with so much farmland deteriorated and infertile and so many people, more than the land could support? So that led to our program, Take Care, which is improving the lives of people in 33 villages around the park in environmentally sustainable ways, particularly working to improve the lives of women, to increase their education, giving scholarships to girls and so forth, so they can go from primary to secondary school. And it was during the development of that program, which I think owes its success to the fact that the whole team is Tanzanian, it was during the development of that program that I began to realize the enormous importance of farming and the difficulties faced by people when there simply isn't enough land. And that really was the first thing, along with the fact that chimpanzees love food, and it's a great delight to watch them finding and eating it and listening to the happy sounds they make when they find a new food source, that's really contributed to this book and helped me to think of writing it.
What do they eat? And what did that make you think about humans?
They eat the same as us. They're omnivores, which means they eat a bit of everything. They eat mostly fruit, but they also eat leaves, blossoms, stems, and things like that. They eat insects. They sometimes hunt. Meat is about 2% of their diet in a year. And so their diet is held up by some to be the perfect diet for us, and perhaps closer to the diet of the hunter-gatherers of this world.
In your book, you start off looking at the animals. Then you talk about common sense farming. Take it from there. What is common sense farming?
Common sense farming is the kind of farming that place all over England when I was growing up. I went to stay on a farm when I was just a small child. Loving animals, growing up in the city of London, it was a treat. And there were cows and pigs and horses, and they were out in the fields. And I was helping to collect the hens' eggs. No battery farms then, hens pecking about in the farmyard. And my first observations of animals came. First of all, I wanted to know how a hen laid an egg, so I had to wait in the hen house for 4 hours to find out. And I was only 4 years old. And secondly, habituating a pig who was out in a field with other pigs. And after 7 days of this glorious holiday and my holding out apple cores each day, he finally took it from my hand. So these experiences with the old kind of farming taught me a lot about farm animals. I knew it was obvious that they were highly intelligent. And it was a real shock when in the mid-70s I read a book, Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, which explained the full horror of intensive farming. I found it hard to believe people could actually treat animals this way, as though they're just machines. And the next time I looked at a piece of meat on my plate, I thought, what does this symbolize? Fear, pain, death. I never ate it again. And, you know, this is very much part of this book. The old common sense farming nurtured the land. The different animals were rotated with the different kinds of crops that were grown. The kind of crops were grown that withstood different environmental situations, flooding or droughts, particularly in Africa, of course. And as big agribusiness is buying up more and more land and crowding these small farmers off their land, it's also enabling them to produce food more and more cheaply, because it's done in such an unethical way to be poisoning us and torturing animals. And because the food is produced more cheaply, that means that the traditional farmers can no longer compete, and they're struggling to survive. They're an endangered species. And I just feel the passionate need to help them by patronizing farmers' markets and buying local and eating local as much as possible, and trying to once again instill in people how exciting it is to wait, as I waited as a child, for different foods to come into season. And now you want a peach in November, you can get one from somewhere, without any thought about the huge amounts of fossil fuel that have been used to bring it to you, and what has been done to this peach to make it still look fresh. All these things. People don't actually think about where their food comes from, how it's produced, and what might be in it.
Talk about the animal factories. I think most people in this country don't have any idea what you're talking about.
You know, the sad thing, they don't want to know. When I try to explain how you have maybe five hens crushed into a tiny wire cage that size for their whole lives to lay eggs, how you have hens crushed in a room, doesn't matter what big it, how big it is, but falling over each other, trampling on dead bodies. Pigs, and we know that pigs are at least as and often more intelligent than dogs. I mean, did you know pigs can actually use a computer? They can be taught to move a cursor with their snouts up and down and side to side and answer questions. And they are these amazingly intelligent animals. And I love pigs. And they're crammed. They can't even turn around. They're in these tiny sties. And the pig having her babies, the sow, is confined under a farrowing hoop, so she can't turn around. She can't even stand up very often. And the cows in the so-called animal food lots, in tiny yards, forced to stand often under the hot sun on baked ground or in the mud mixed with feces. And then comes the abattoir, the slaughterhouse. And because each second means money, although it's law to stun an animal before you start slitting it up, if the stunning gun misses, which it often does, the bolt of electricity, then they start slitting up the live animals. I mean, this has been shown again and again. But what I was saying is, if you start telling people about all this, so many people say, don't tell me, I'm very sensitive and I love animals. And I'm thinking, this doesn't make sense.
And how does bioengineered, genetically modified foods fit into this picture?
Well, I have a serious mistrust of them. You know, you remember Rachel Carson wrote that book way back when, Silent Spring, and she was talking about the bad effect, the cumulative effect of DDT in the environment and in animals' bodies. It took 30 years to show that DDT did accumulate and was a very, very highly dangerous chemical. Initially, it was thought to be harmless. It wasn't anybody's bad intention. And in the same way, we cannot predict the long-term cumulative effect of many of the other chemicals being used today, nor can we predict the long-term cumulative effect of genetically modified crops on the environment, but also on our own health. You know, recently some genetically modified corn intended for cattle escaped into the stores, and people got very sick. Now, okay, that was intended for cattle, and maybe their cattle don't get sick, but we eating their flesh. And animals, by and large, don't like genetically modified food. They wanted to test some tomatoes on rats, and they actually had to use stomach pumps before the rats would even eat them.
How did they detect the difference?
I suppose it's smell. I don't know. Maybe it's taste. We don't know. And nobody's really studied why they don't do it. They also prefer organic food, which, of course, is the answer for us. Organic food is free from pollution. It's free from GMO, genetically modified crops.
Tell us about the activism against genetically modified crops. Mm-hmm. You have pictures in your book of people digging them up.
Yes.
And in this country, it is way behind in the protest movement that's much more advanced in Europe.
Yes, and unfortunately for Americans, it's very difficult to know whether GM food is actually, you know, in what you're eating, because there's no labeling required. Whereas in Europe, it's required to state whether or not GM foods are in this particular product. So in Europe, I think probably led by Prince Charles in the UK anyway, people are very mistrustful. There is quite a lot of science, and I'm not going to pretend to go into the science, but a lot of science that is quite strongly against GM foods. And so people go out into the fields and pull up the crops to such an extent that in most cases the companies trying to develop GM crops have given up. They're not prepared to do it anymore because it keeps getting pulled up. It's not just UK, it's England, Germany, Italy, India, Japan. And Percy Schmeiser, who is, his case history is in this book. He's the one Canadian farmer who actually dared stand up to one of the giants of the GM movement, that's Monsanto. And he was actually prosecuted in court for violating Monsanto patent on canola, even though it was the wind or the bees or something like that that had brought the corn into his field in the first place. He was growing it, and therefore he received a letter to say he was in violation of their patent. And in court, you know, he was told that he was in violation, but he didn't have to pay. So it was sort of, you know, but he, anyway, he's traveling the world now, all over the world. I spoke to him last week, and I think right now he's in Nigeria.
Jane Goodall, primatologist and author. Her latest book is Harvest for Hope, A Guide to Mindful Eating. And we'll be back with her in a minute.
What if we could circle the world, flying peace doves beneath the sun? Giant 20-foot wings of fabric that are handmade by everyone. Once a year we circle the world, saying, ain't it time to bury the guns? Our time has come and we have begun to circle the world. It's a dream and it's a vision, it's a prayer that we may see. When every person, every creature will be treated with dignity. When every war will be a memory we never shall repeat. Our time has come and we have begun to circle the world. What if we could circle the world, flying peace doves beneath the sun? Giant 20-foot wings of fabric that are...
Dana Lyons, Circle the World, title track to a CD that he recorded with Jane Goodall. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
We're talking to Jane Goodall, who is known for studying chimpanzees for decades and has now written a book, Harvest for Hope, A Guide to Mindful Eating. In this country, there are laws against food disparagement, you may have heard. Oprah Winfrey was sued by the National Cattlemen's Association for saying on her broadcast that she would never eat another hamburger again.
I know, and good for her. But I know that there's a company being sued right now because on its label it says it doesn't have genetically modified food. It's hard for me to see how this can be a law case, but...
And not sued because, in fact, they do have GM food. And this, for example, Ben & Jerry's company dealt with this also. But by saying that, they imply that there's something wrong with genetically modified food.
You can say they do, and that's obviously what the law says. But, you know, there need to be people standing up for what they believe to be the truth.
What do you think is the answer right now? And you travel the world. When I asked you where you lived earlier, you basically said in an airplane.
Yes.
What are the differences you see between this country and other countries you've been in?
There are differences at different levels, but for one thing, as you mentioned, there is much more awareness about what genetically modified food is in Europe, for example. But if I'm asked to say, you know, what do you really see as a difference? Well, between the developing world and this country, to some extent Europe, but especially the United States, waste. We waste so much. We waste food. We waste water. You go to a restaurant. I mean, it hurts me. It's not just because of the developing world. I remember back to the war years when food was rationed. I remember Tanzania when it was at the bottom of its economy after the war with Uganda. And food was hard to get, but people couldn't buy bread for a long time. There was no sugar. And we had to barter. We'd go to one part of the country and come back with cooking oil and barter it for sugar that some people had brought back from somewhere else. And a lot of people couldn't afford to do that. So the waste that I see in a restaurant where people's plates are piled with food and so much of it goes back and it has to be binned. It's not even safe to feed it to animals today in case you get sued for something or other.
You were talking about what happens to pigs, what happens to chickens. What about ducks?
Ducks with the force feeding for pâté foie gras. That's almost the cruelest of all, whether these metal or plastic tubes are forced down into the duck's gullet and fatty substances are pumped in and it makes their liver expand to about 10 times its normal size. And only finally then is the bird killed. Meanwhile, they suffer many, much damage and infections. And you can imagine with a tube being put down the neck. Imagine if it was yours.
And
veal. little calves in these tiny, tiny crates where they can barely lie down. If they do lie down, they can hardly stand. And because people like the flesh to be white, towards the end, they're deprived of iron, so they even try and drink their own urine. So when they go out to slaughter, their legs break because they can't walk, which is the same for pigs and lots of other animals too. I mean, it's very, very cruel. You cannot get away from the fact that intensive farming, creating huge amounts of meat, is cruel. But more than that, it's damaging the land because it takes a huge amount more land to produce so many pounds of animal protein, whether you're grazing the cattle or whether you're growing corn to feed the cattle, than it does. That same piece of ground will grow far more vegetable protein from cereals grown on that land. And then there's the question of the water. It takes gallons and gallons more water to raise one cow than the equivalent amount of vegetable protein.
And what would you say to the animal farmers, the mass, large corporate, for example, hog farmers and others, who say it's more efficient to do it this way?
It's more efficient in that they can produce more meat quickly and therefore sell it cheaper. But if you balance against all of that, the suffering of the animals, the contamination of the environment from the animal waste, which is huge, and finally the sickness of people who are eating things that we shouldn't be eating. And again, I come back to the children, and children's health is suffering. And in addition, we have this epidemic of obesity, which comes from fast foods. So, you know, the antidote is to buy organic food if you can and to eat locally when you can, to support farmers' markets and to go back to an old feeling of when we used to feel in touch with our food. And I'm thrilled at some of the movements that are happening. I mean, that's the hopeful part of this book, that there are all these movements going on, like the slow food movement.
Explain the slow food movement.
Slow food movement is the opposite of fast food, and it simply means, you know, that you once again cook, that you buy locally grown food, that you're in touch with the land. And I'm not quite sure why they call it slow food, except it's the opposite of fast food, which is just quick, quick, quick. Don't think, buy, pop in a microwave oven, open a packet, eat it. This requires cooking your food, knowing about your food. And then there's the wonderful programs, growing food in school gardens and teaching children to cook. And there are the farmers markets.
How do these movements fit in, and how do you fit in to the anti-corporate globalization movement in this country and around the world?
See, it's a very complex, difficult kind of thing to tackle, really. But I think it boils down to this, that in the old days, many of the indigenous people, before they made a major decision, like, let's cut down all this forest and grow grass for grazing cattle to make hamburgers. Before making such a decision, the elders would gather and ask themselves, how will this decision we make now affect our people in seven generations to come? But today, so many decisions are made in relation to the next shareholders' meeting. So in other words, it's making a quick buck now, and it's not thinking about the future. And what I find so extraordinary is that with this amazing brain we have, and our ability, I mean, think what we've done with it. We've sent people to the moon. We've created an incredible network that enables us to communicate around the world. You and I could be talking to people in China live this minute if we wanted. It's amazing. And the advances in medical technology, incredible. And yet at the same time, we can create weapons of mass destruction. We can destroy huge areas of the environment. And we are destroying the planet upon which we live. We're harming our own health. So what's happened? How did this, how could this have happened? And I can only think that there's some disconnect gone wrong between the brain and the human heart, where our compassion lives, that we've lost or are losing wisdom. And being clever and being wise are two different things. And we've got to somehow work to reinstall the values that make people wise in our children, which is why I'm spending so much time with our youth program, Roots and Shoots, now in 90 countries. This is the reason for my crazy 300 days a year travel. It's growing this program with materials from preschool right through university. And it's changing lives in the inner city. It's changing lives in rural areas.
And you do what?
Every group chooses three different kinds of project. Initially, to improve the world around them. Firstly, for their own human community. Second, for animals, including domestic animals. Third, for the environment. And woven throughout it all is the sense of living in peace and harmony with each other, with the animal kingdom, and with the natural world. And it's very much about breaking down barriers that we erect between people of different cultures, countries, religions, between us and the animal kingdom. And it really is changing the world. It's not that children can make change. They are making change. They're cleaning streams. They're clearing up litter. They're helping the elderly walk their dogs. They're doing things locally, feeling good about it, and then reaching out, like helping Katrina victims, helping the victims of tsunami and the Pakistan earthquake. They're connected around the world with this wonderful communication network, and they're with others who do have compassion, who do care for the future. They get it. So if we can get a critical mass of youth that is moving in a direction away from the materialistic morals, ethic, or lack of ethic and lack of morals of so many people in the modern world today, then maybe then we can reclaim wisdom.
How does war fit into this picture? And peace?
War and peace. War is devastating to the environment. It's devastating to human life. And so often people talk about, you know, damage done to civilians, and doesn't it matter that the soldiers are also torn apart? They have the same feelings as the civilians. So many go off to fight, not because they really want to, but because they're pushed into it, forced into it, peer pressure to get a job, whatever it happens to be. And I don't think we can ever learn to live in real harmony with nature while we're fighting. But equally, we'll never be able to lay down our weapons worldwide until we learn to live in harmony with nature. The big wars, they say, are going to be fought over water, access to water. Big businesses buying up the aquifers.
When we spoke earlier, you said you've been warned about using the word peace.
It seems that, I don't understand this, but it seems that peace has become a political word. For me, that's not so. Peace means being able to live in harmony with each other. And I was made a UN messenger of peace, and Kofi Annan did that because of Roots and Shoots, because I could honestly say, Kofi, wherever I go, I'm spreading seeds of global peace. We have our own Roots and Shoots Peace Day. And because when you're made a messenger of peace, a little dove is pinned to you. For some reason, I'm not wearing mine today, but here it is on your mug. Then one of the Roots and Shoots groups in New York created this giant peace dove puppet out of old sheets, recycled sheets, and a bit of chicken wire. And when I was wondering how I could help promote the UN Day of Peace, I thought, yes, we'll fly these around the world. So we had our Peace Day on the 24th of September. I think we flew doves in about 50 countries. In Los Angeles, they flew 30 in a wonderful parade. I was on the Snake River flying two doves on two canoes. And you know, my vision is that the day will come when, as the sun goes around the world, these giant wings will spread out and you'll be able to look down from a satellite and see them. And surely, because the young people are building into these doves their own commitment to living in peace with themselves and their family, their environment, then some of these dreams will drift off in the wind and settle on areas still torn apart by conflict.
So who's warning you against using the word peace?
It's just that some NGOs are being warned that there are certain things which they shouldn't be using, certain words that will bring them in disrepute. And peace, it can't be true, can it? That cannot be a political... Peace is something we all aspire to. Peace is something every child dreams about. You ask children around the world what are their dreams, and one of the things they'll say is peace. I don't believe there's a single living person who really wants to be involved in a war if there was any way out.
Well, Jane Goodall, as we wrap up, your plans for the future and how they're informed by what you've done, living very remotely, first, well, in your 20s with animals, with the chimpanzees, do you have hope for the future as you look at the powers that are arrayed against the principles that you care about?
That's the question I'm asked most often. Could I really have hope when I see animal species becoming extinct, when I see forests giving place to deserts, when I see the suffering, the poverty in so much of the developing world, and the sickness, the hunger, when I see the ethnic violence everywhere, and the tremendous social injustice? Do I really have hope for peace? And I wouldn't write books about peace if I didn't have hope. And maybe my hope for peace is, and my hope for the future, and my hope that we'll get out of this mess, this monstrous mess that we find ourselves in. Maybe they're simplistic, maybe they're idealistic, but they work for me, the human brain. And, you know, if you actually check around to see what people have invented that will allow us to live in more harmony with nature. I mean, there are many, many scientists who say if we would just do these things and stop talking about them, we have the way to get out of so much of the mess we've made. So that's one reason for hope, and that more people are thinking about the way they live and realizing that what we do each day does, in fact, have an impact on the world. Second reason for hope, the resilience of nature, the places we destroy which can be given a second chance, the animal species on the very brink of extinction, in some cases down to just two individuals, but they can too be given a second chance if we care enough.
Jane Goodall, author of Harvest for Hope, A Guide for Mindful Eating, the world-renowned primatologist. And that does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like to see or listen to the podcast of today's show, go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper. Special thanks to Mike DeFilippo, Angela Alston, Orlando Richards, and Peter Hune. And again, if you'd like to go to our website, you not only can see the broadcast, you can listen to the broadcast, and you can read the broadcast. Our transcripts are available free to anyone who goes to that site, and you could pass it around to friends for the holidays. We thank you so much for being with us. Also, our headlines are in Spanish on a regular basis at democracynow.org. Tell your friends. Tomorrow, a special on Yip Harburg, the man who put the rainbow in The Wizard of Oz. Also, special thanks to Susie Salami, Karen Renucci, Dennis Moynihan, Jenny Filippazzo, Neil Shibata. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.